On today's episode of Locked Up with History, we'll be looking at the murder of Elizabeth Dixon and her daughters, Julia and Elizabeth, near Ballarat in 1864. What drove their husband and their father to slay them in cold blood? Stay tuned.
Warning. This podcast contains discussions of some potentially distressing topics. Listeners, please be advised. Come with us for true and tall tales unsurpassed, with stories from Victoria's dark colonial past. Spirits, executions, ghosts, murders and ghouls. These are the stories they don't teach you at school. All these twisted tales of mystique and mystery coming to you now on Locked Up With History.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Locked Up with History, Episode 7. My name is Deb Robinson, and on today's episode, we're going to be talking about the brutal murder of Elizabeth Dixon, or Dives, and her daughters Julia, age 3, and Elizabeth, age 1, in 1864. All three were slain with an axe by their father, Elijah Dixon, otherwise known as Charles Alfred Dives. The couple's two sons were spared, although 2 years later, the youngest son was the only one still alive. But first, let's set the scene of where this event took place. Ballarat was, of course, one of the key gold mining areas in Victoria in the 1850s, being considered one of the richest alluvial goldfields in the world. Many had come to the area to make their fortunes, with about 6,000 miners arriving each week in the early days. By the 1860s, Ballarat was transforming from gold mining to an industrial city, with the connection of the railway from Geelong. The murders took place in an area about 2 miles from Sebastopol and about 5 miles from Ballarat, known as Cherry Tree Flat. It was also located in a valley that had been named Murdering Gully, a name that was now horribly and aptly appropriate. It was named Murdering Gully for a previous murder in April 1838, when a shepherd on an outstation of the Learmonth Brothers' holding, named Terence McManus, was killed by Aboriginals. The Dixon's hut was located near the big water hole on the road from Smythesdale to Buninyong, about 200 yards from the road. The view from the front windows of the hut looked out over a sloping upland occupied by 20-acre allotments, green with growing crops and dotted with the homes of the industrious holders. To the right were the cultivation patches leading to the Bonshaw paddocks and the tops of the White Horse Ranges and Mount Helen and Mount Buninyong in the distance, as it was so vividly described in the Ballarat Star. The hut itself was comprised of two sections, with the front having been built onto the original bush hut at the back. The front lean-to had a bedroom and a living room, floored with wood, a panel door and sash windows. The living room measured about 11 feet by 9 feet, or about 3.3 metres by 2.7, with the bedroom 9 feet by 7 feet, or 2.7 by 2.1, so not very much room at all. The furnishings were sparse, with only a trunk full of clothes and a sack of potatoes in the living room. The original part, which was now the kitchen, had an earthen floor that measured 18 feet by 9 feet, or about 5.4 metres by 2.7. In here were two large pieces of beef, along with the usual cooking utensils one would expect, and in one corner, close to where the front bedroom was, an area about 6 feet square had been enclosed with a rude bush bedstead.
For a fascinating look at life in a colonial prison, visit Geelong Jail Museum. Situated just over an hour from Melbourne in the heart of Geelong, it's Victoria's most intact and longest continually operating colonial prison. For information, search for Geelong Jail or call 1300 865 800.
Elijah Dixon was born in April 1830 in Bermondsey, Surrey, as always, please excuse my pronunciation, to William Dixon and his wife Mary. He was the second eldest of 4 children. Little is known of his early life, but on the 1851 census, he is listed as a baker's journeyman. The family were poor, with Mary and William both being interred in the workhouses more than once in their lifetimes. And this might explain the story that Elijah gave of his early life when he was being assessed for lunacy in the Ballarat jail in August 1862. To Dr. Bunce, he told the story of how his name was Charles Alfred Dives, but he had been brought up by the Dixon family. He'd left when he was 12 years of age to find work. When he was about 18, he was working as a baker and delivering Sally Lunns, a type of Boston bun whose recipe has been handed down since the 1680s. To a customer who had told him he was his son, Elijah was told that he would inherit the Marlborough property and all of the estate. Was there any truth in this, or was it just pure fantasy to hide a poor upbringing? Elizabeth was born in 1833 to Joseph Robinson and his wife, whose name is unknown. Nothing is known of her early life until her marriage to Elijah in November 1854 at the parish church at St. Saviour, Southwark in Surrey. The newly married couple arrived in Australia in March 1855 aboard the Moor's Foot, arriving in Port Phillip Bay, although Elijah was using the name of James Dixon. His name seemed to be interchangeable a lot of the time. Their first child, James Edward Dixon, was born at Dunedin, just outside of Geelong, in 1855. But by the birth of their second child, Alfred Ennis Dixon, in 1857, the couple were living in Ballarat. Two daughters followed, with Julia in 1859 and Elizabeth in 1861, all born and registered in Ballarat. Now, Elijah was reportedly a hard-working man who'd lived in the Sebastopol area for several years, working initially as a baker and then as a miner on the Red Jacket claim, before being employed as a timber cutter and splitter. The marriage was not a happy one by all accounts, with rumours of Elizabeth having been intimate with other men, something that was a large part of newspaper discussions after her death. But what we do know is that for whatever reason, Elizabeth and the two girls returned to England about mid-1862. In January 1863, Elijah was charged with deserting his children and leaving them with no means of support. Now, this would have been the two boys, Alfred and James, who were still with their father at Cherry Tree Flat. Sergeant Shepherd testified that the neighbours had brought the children's plight to his attention and that Elijah was not in his right mind, having been charged with lunacy just a few months before. Elijah testified that he had a house and work, and he was let off with a caution by the courts. In August 1863, Elizabeth and the two girls returned to Australia aboard the Pegasus and returned to the hut at Cherry Tree Flat. It was stated in some newspapers that she had conducted herself with propriety and marked womanly habits of cleanliness, and she had endeavoured to surround herself with little ornaments of a little bush home. It was also noted that since her return, Elijah, now using the name of Charles Dives, had made an effort with his appearance, being clean and neatly dressed and wearing his wedding ring again. All seemed happy in the Dixon Dives household, but looks can be deceiving. Sometime before sunrise on October 5th, 1863, Elijah Dixon rose from the bed he was sharing with James and Alfred. He picked up an axe and he made his way to the bedroom at the front of the hut, where his wife and his daughters lay asleep. He raised the axe, bringing the back of it down onto Elizabeth's sleeping head, killing her instantly. He then pulled the blankets back where the two girls were asleep behind their mother, taking them out and laying them on the floor. He then took the axe to both Julia and Elizabeth, killing them. Elijah then closed the door and dragged a heavy trunk in front of the door. Returning to the bed he shared with his sons, Alfred asked what the noise was, to which Elijah replied, "It was just a goat."
If you'd like to visit some of the places featured on Locked Up With History, book in a tour with Twisted History. For the full range of tours and to book, visit twistedhistory.net.au.
At about 6 a.m. on the morning of the 5th of October 1863, Charles Dives and his sons James and Alfred entered the general store of Isaac Pike. Isaac asked him how he was, to which he initially replied, "First rate." But it was quickly followed by, "I'm miserable." When Pike asked why, Dives replied, "I've cooked her goose. She's dead enough." Leaving Dives with the boys in his shop, Pike enlisted the help of a neighbour, John Perry, and they went to the hut to investigate the truthfulness of Dives' claim. They entered the hut through the back door of the kitchen and made their way to the bedroom. A heavy trunk had to be moved from the door to gain entry to the room, where they discovered the bodies of Elizabeth, Julia and infant Elizabeth, along with an axe propped up near the window. The two men felt sick by the scene before them as they had no idea that Dives had murdered his daughters along with his wife. Pike and Perry returned to the store where Dives was sitting on the veranda smoking a pipe. Dives admitted to Pike that he had intended to kill the boys and himself as well, but that his heart had failed him. The police were sent for, and Constables Darling and Kelleher arrived from the Sebastopol camp to take Charles Dives into custody. After being cautioned, Dives replied, "I will admit nothing." Constables Darling and Kelleher took Dives back to the house. On entering the front bedroom, police observed the bed parallel to the window with the toilet table in between. An axe was leaning near the window, covered with blood, and the victim's hair was very apparent, especially the light-coloured hair of the girls. Elizabeth lay on her left side where the children had once been behind her in the bed. Her face was covered with bloody gore and froth, yet her braid behind her was untouched by the gruesome scene. There was a bloody handprint on the bedclothes where Dives had removed the girls before killing them. Both the girls were dressed only in their nightshirts and lay touching on the floor in a pool of blood, a mixture of theirs and Elizabeth's that had soaked through the bed. Julia lay on her face with her arms and legs outstretched as if she was asleep. Her skull was obviously smashed in, and there were wounds on the left side of her face, on the cheek and the ear. Elizabeth laid on her right side facing her sister, also with her skull smashed by the axe and long cuts along her face dividing her earlobe. There were no signs of struggle from any of the victims, and it was believed that they were all asleep when they met their deaths. When questioned why he killed them, Charles Dives replied, "Their affairs are settled. Let mine go as they will." The inquest was held on October 7th before Dr. Glendinning at Cherry Tree Flat, with the jury witnessing the bodies of the victims where they lay in the bedroom of the Dives' hut. Testimony from James stated that he had woken up to a coughing noise from his mother's bedroom, which his father said was just Julia coughing. He remembered his father lighting a fire that was blazing up the chimney and that he never went to bed again. James also stated that his parents had frequently quarrelled. His brother Alfred testified that he had heard a hammering noise and that his mother screeching three times and his sister crying once. He also said that Charles and Elizabeth had argued the night before and that his father was cross when they went to bed. Neither of the boys knew how old they were. Dr. Richard Bunce testified that he had performed the postmortems on the three victims. He was also the doctor who had deemed Elijah Dixon fit to be at large when he was jailed for lunacy in 1862 at Ballarat Jail. Dr. Bunce found that Elizabeth had a fractured right temporal bone, and the top of her skull was also fractured and pressing into her brain, which had caused her death. Julia had an incised wound about 4 inches long from the left ear to the back of the skull, through which her brain was protruding. She also had another wound on the right side of her head that had cut through her earlobe. Elizabeth had a 3-inch incised wound that cut through her left ear to the back of her skull, with bone protruding through the wound. Dr. Bunce testified that all wounds could have been caused by the axe found in the room. The inquest closed, and Dr. Glenning found that Elizabeth, Julia, and Elizabeth Dives, alias Dixon, whose death took place on Sunday night or Monday morning in their own house on Cherry Tree Flat in the parish of Cardigan, and were caused by fractures of each of their skulls by blows willfully and maliciously inflicted on them by an axe on the same day and same place by Charles Alfred Dives, commonly known as Elijah Dixon. Charles Alfred Dives was sent to trial at the Ballarat Circuit Court on October 16, 1863, before Sir Redmond Barry, with Mr. Trench as the Crown Prosecutor and Mr. McDermott defending the prisoner. Dives pled not guilty and sat in the dock showing little emotion to the testimony presented by the witnesses. At times he would chew on his cap. Sir Redmond Barry rejected James as unfit to give evidence because of defects in his theology. He had been called and examined as to his knowledge of the oath. Testimony was presented on Dives' mental capacity, with stories of how he believed that Elizabeth was trying to sedate him with chloroform on a handkerchief placed on his head so that she might be intimate with other men. Another story was that of seeing and speaking with a dead man named Hugh McBride while he was out cutting wood near Sago Hill. McBride had been dead for 4 months at the time. The defence called two witnesses in Dr. Louis Sanger, who had been affiliated with a lunatic asylum in Vienna, and also Robert Hudson, who had both testified as to Dives' insanity. Dr. Sanger observed the prisoner as a lunatic. He pronounced that all persons with hydrocephalic heads to be irresponsible. Dives was placed in this category, and Dr. Sanger was convinced after hearing the evidence that the prisoner was not responsible for his actions. Sir Edmund Barry directed the jury that the plea of insanity might be used, but that it was up to the jury to decide whether the prisoner was insane or not, either at the time of the murder or any time before or since. The jury retired for just 15 minutes before acquitting Charles Alfred Dives on the grounds of insanity. He was sentenced to be held at Her Majesty's pleasure and removed to the Ballarat jail.
You're listening to Locked Up with History.
Now, you might think that this is the end of this very sad tale of jealousy and insanity, but sadly, it's not. There are a few more stories yet to add. James and Alfred, with their mother now dead and their father incarcerated for an unspecified time, were taken to the Ballarat Benevolent Asylum in Ascot Street to be cared for. Originating in 1857, the Ballarat Benevolent Asylum was a charitable association to help the sick and the needy. Completed in 1859, the first building provided accommodation for 80 inmates. Also accepted were orphaned children up until 1868, when an institution was built especially for them. Unfortunately, Alfred was only there for 2 weeks before he died. Medical officials and attendants would say that he had been in a despondent state since the murders and that they were unable to induce him to play sports or interact with the other children. Alfred was buried in the old Ballarat Cemetery, where his mothers and sisters had been interred in a public grave just a couple of weeks before. A few days later, Charles was allowed to say goodbye to James at the Benevolent Asylum before being transferred to Melbourne Jail to serve his time. Dives would fight against his sentence and beg to be released, with many appeals sent to the Executive Council. But none were responded to favourably, and he remained in jail. Dives made numerous attempts to escape custody, but these were also foiled. The last attempt to escape was on the day before his death, where he attempted to escape from the jail yard whilst out on exercise. As he had not been sentenced to hard labour, he was allowed to associate with other prisoners who had similar punishments. Melbourne jail staff would report that Charles Dives had never reconciled himself to being incarcerated. However, he showed no signs of lunacy while in the Melbourne jail. On October 23, 1865, Charles Dives was mustered at 5 p.m. and then confined to his cell. The cell was in the old section of the jail and had an additional iron-grated door along with the customary door. Sometime after being locked in his cell, Dives fashioned a noose out of a white silk handkerchief and tied it to the top of the door. He then climbed up the bars to the noose, placing it around his neck. At 8 p.m, when turnkey James Rowley was doing his rounds, he found the deceased man with his feet just 6 inches above the floor. Life was extinct. And that left James Alfred Dixon, now an orphan with all of his siblings also deceased. James was made a ward of the state as a neglected child in September 1865, having spent the 2 years previous still at the Benevolent Asylum. During his term, he was sent to the Nelson in 1868. The Nelson was a reformatory ship for boys, which had previously been used by the Navy to train the crew of the Cerberus. James was licensed out to civil engineer in South Yarra before his term expired in September 1869. James married Catherine O'Meara in 1876, and the couple went on to have 2 children, who both died in infancy. Catherine passed away in 1911, aged 63 years, and James followed her in 1939 at the grand age of 87 years, having become a gentleman of independent means. They were both buried at the St Kilda Cemetery.
Interested in learning more about this episode? Join the Locked Up With History Facebook group for more facts and discussions about the dark colonial past of Victoria and beyond.
Now, before we wrap up the story on the Dixon Dives family, please don't forget to check out our webpage at www.lockedupwithhistory.com.au, where all of the previous episodes are, along with some of the photos for the episodes where we have them. Of course, you can also listen to all of the episodes on your favourite podcast streaming platform. If you have any questions or would like to discuss any of the episodes, join us over on Facebook and the Locked Up With History group. This is where you can ask me any questions on the current episodes and where you can also view any of the media associated with the episodes. On our next episode, we will be looking at a rather cheeky escape from the Geelong jail of John McHenry in 1869, where he returned his stolen convict uniform at the governor's expense, no less. Until then, see you on the darker side of history.
for more information on the story from today's episode, check out the show notes or join the Locked Up With History Facebook group. Remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.